Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. There are approximately 1.5 million people in the Central Coast region, and they rely on groundwater for over 80% of their potable supply. In some areas like the Salinas Valley, groundwater accounts for almost 100% of the drinking water supply, as well as the agricultural and the industrial supply. Now, nitrate pollution is one of the most widespread and severe public health and water quality problems in our region as well as the state. Major portions of entire groundwater basins and aquifers are polluted with nitrate. And the data documenting the significance of this problem is overwhelming, along with the numerous lines of evidence documenting that irrigated agriculture is by far the largest source of the ongoing nitrate pollution within our region as well as the state. Subsequently, there are thousands of people within our region that are potentially susceptible to having their drinking water polluted with nitrate, and this is particularly true for people within disadvantaged communities that are generally in rural agricultural areas of our region. Although a number of case studies in our region indicate that we will see improved drinking water conditions in localized areas in relatively short time periods, it's likely going to take several decades before we start to see improving water quality conditions on a regional scale in our region as a result of reduced nitrate discharges. Consequently, it's going to take a long-term commitment from us and various other state agencies and local agencies if we're going to effectively address this significant water quality and public health problem. The good news is that there are studies available now that indicate that significant reductions in fertilizer application and the subsequent discharges to groundwater are achievable using readily available nutrient management and irrigation management techniques, and that in some cases implementation of those methods will result in a cost savings to growers. And for various crops, reduced fertilizer application will also likely achieve drinking water standards in the water that's being discharged from agricultural areas to groundwater. I want you to look away really quickly. I'm going to have to skip over this next slide because it unfortunately contains information from the recent Harder report that was referenced by Tess. And I'm going to skip right to this one here. Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory recently conducted two nitrate-focused studies in our region, the most recent of which was a nitrate bait and transport study in the Salinas Valley that indicated that chemical fertilizer is the primary source of nitrate in groundwater and surface water in areas where nitrate concentrations are above background levels. Moreover, the study documented that the nitrate pollution within the San Gerardo cooperative well was from chemical fertilizer, and also that in some wells within the Salinas Valley that the nitrate pollution is from recent agricultural discharges and not that of legacy pollution that occurred decades ago. We had the draft of that report prior to the August
closing.
You
have the draft, was it made publicly available for comment?
Tess, why don't you come up to the podium to make your comments?
Sorry about that. I just was asking for a verification whether this 2011 report that he's referring to was available for review and response to before the close of the written comment period.
Was that better? Was what you just said is that there's a draft of the report, and this information was in the draft of the report. And when was that draft report?
When was it publicly available?
Yes.
I'm not sure, but it was available to us well before the August.
Yeah, but available to you, but was it available to us?
And I believe it
right,
is
I think it, I believe that it was referenced in the staff reports during the past 3 years of this.
Well, the 2011 report.
It's actually referenced as preliminary results within Appendix G.
Let me
just asking for further clarification as to when and where this draft report was referenced to within, you know, the staff report prior to the close of the written comment period in August.
We referenced the preliminary results within Appendix G of the March 2011 staff report.
And is the 2011 reference that you're talking about here the exact same report that was referenced?
Would you like us to look that up and verify that?
Yes. And you know, while you're doing that, why don't you just go on, Matt, with the rest of your presentation?
There was another study within the August groundwater basin, which is in the Morgan Hill and Gilroy areas, and it documented similar findings with regard to chemical fertilizer and irrigated agriculture being the primary source of nitrate nitrogen within groundwater, as well as recent discharges from agriculture versus legacy pollution, and also documented increasing nitrate trends over time. And these are very technical and highly personal reports, but the bottom line is that they indicate that real people, like the two women that are pictured here from the San Gerardo Cooperative, are affected by nitrate pollution from chemical fertilizer. Now, the cost associated with dealing with nitrate-polluted drinking water is significant, as you can see from some of the real cost examples that we have shown here for our region. And as you've heard during previous workshops and presentations, that people who live within disadvantaged communities are typically paying a higher portion of these costs because they live within, you know, usually within rural agricultural areas that are more susceptible to nitrate pollution. In some cases, people in these areas are paying for a drinking water supply that's not safe to drink while also having to pay for bottled water. And this is a reality that the people of San Gerardo lived for several years. Now, as pointed out here, San Gerardo just got a new well for a cost of over $4 million, but how long is it going to be before their new well's polluted with nitrate? How long is it going to take for them to replace it, and at what cost? Our highest priorities are focused on identifying and protecting the most at-risk portion of the population from nitrate pollution, who may not be aware of the risks and or can't afford clean water. And these include domestic well owners, farm labor camps, schools, and local communities within, you know, rural agricultural areas, and obviously with an emphasis on disadvantaged communities. And we've been focusing on the protection of the domestic and municipal beneficial uses of drinking water because of how significant the water quality and the public health threats are, along with the costs associated with dealing with it. But we're also responsible for protecting the two other beneficial uses of groundwater, which are industrial supply and agricultural supply. Now, nitrate can also be problematic for certain industrial processes and typically needs to be removed along with other minerals before use. Data also show that groundwater in agricultural areas, in some areas, exceeds our water quality objectives in the basin plan for irrigation on certain types of crops, like citrus, avocados, and grapes. And this is also true for some surface waters in our region. Now, we may be rapidly approaching maximum nitrate thresholds for other high-value crops in our region, given we're in uncharted territory with increasingly high nitrate concentrations in groundwater. Nitrate concentrations in agricultural areas are also at levels that could be harmful to livestock and other animals. And according to nitrate toxicity guidelines for cattle, there are wells in our region that have nitrate concentrations that are high enough to kill a cow. And so we need to be conscious that, you know, we're not just looking at protecting the drinking water beneficial uses, but also these other beneficial uses to ensure that we can have sustainable agricultural and, you know, other communities in our region. And that concludes my presentation.
The 2011 preliminary report by Lawrence Livermore Lab was referenced in the March 2011 staff report text as well as in Appendix G.
And I didn't pick all that up, Lisa. Was this available to the public?
Yes, those staff reports were made available.
Yes, Appendix G was part of the staff report.
Okay.
Through the chair, I thought there wasn't a follow-up question about whether what we saw just now was exactly what was in that early 2011 report. Something to that effect.
Yeah, the data didn't change. It's the same information.
Okay. All right, who's up next?
Karen Worcester of our staff, who is our manager of our Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program.
Speak up.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chairman Young, members of the board. Okay, how's that? I'm going to be briefly discussing some of the priority water quality issues that Roger mentioned in his introduction in surface waters of our region, focusing on the two high priority areas in the Santa Maria and Lower Salinas. In a state board report entitled Toxicity in California Waters describes Central Coast streams as having the highest percent of toxic sites statewide. When looking at a combined data set of information from multiple projects, over half of the sites in our region were toxic, and almost a quarter of those sites were highly toxic. In particular, Salinas and Santa Maria areas are severely impaired by toxicity. These maps come off of our website, the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program website. The grayish blue areas are where irrigated agriculture is located. The brown areas, sort of see them below the sampling sites here. This is the Salinas, City of Santa Maria. The dots on the map are where we have samples collected either by our program or by the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Agriculture. Green dots have shown no toxicity at all. But you can see in these in the lower Salinas and lower Santa Maria areas, most of the sites that we have monitored or that we have data on are highly toxic. These dark red dots are toxic. At least half the time they're sampled, and in some cases, always. Just to clarify, toxicity is a measure of effects to a test organism. So we take a sample, take it to the lab, expose a test organism to that water, and the organism, then we measure survival. So in these dark red sites, the organisms are dying. One of those sites that we're particularly concerned about is just above this important estuary at Santa Maria River mouth. This location is supports several threatened and endangered species. And you can see by the data here, 100% of the samples that have been collected there for invertebrates in sediment have been toxic, and almost as many have been toxic in water because of pesticide concentrations. In addition, we're seeing pesticides and fungicides in fish tissue in this lagoon. There are sport fishermen downstream of this along the beach in this area. In terms of the benthic health, there are no bugs in this system you consider, quote, trout food, mayflies, caddisflies, stoneflies. In fact, there are none in the lower Salinas area at all, or sorry, Santa Maria area at all. Which is one of our primary indicators of health in a creek system. So we consider this system extremely impaired. This is a map of the same area looking at nitrate concentrations. Again, similar pattern to toxicity with widespread violations of our drinking water standard throughout the area. The darkest red dots here, at least half of the samples collected at these sites have exceeded the drinking water standard, and in most cases, this is by multiple fold. The site circled in pink here is the same site I just showed you at the Santa Maria Estuary. And you can see at the concentration graph at the bottom, the red line is our drinking water standard at 10 here. EPA and others working on aquatic life issues would consider 1 protective for aquatic life, so it's much lower than the drinking water standard. And you can see we've had concentrations as high as 100 in this site just above our estuary. Extremely impaired. You can also see, just for reference, the point at which the Cooperative Monitoring Program for Agriculture started. So this is a mix of data from both our program and their program. Very similar results in the lower Salinas area. In this case, the site I'm highlighting at the old Salinas River discharges directly into Moss Landing, and then waters are taken up into Elkhorn Slough from there. So similar situation where we have important estuarine resources that some of the highest concentrations in our region are discharging to. This site, again, averaging twice the drinking water standard and exceeding it by multiple fold at times. This data is not the first to acknowledge these very high concentrations. This was a report that came out many years ago in the mid-90s, and this quote from that report stating that the extraordinarily high nitrate concentrations in this system may be the highest recorded in scientific literature for a river or estuary. This data is from the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. This is a nitrate probe near the Moss Landing Harbor in the old Salinas system. And you can see they're showing similar trends. This is starting in 2004 to the data that we've collected, increasing over time. Okay, in summary, particularly in the lower Salinas and Santa Maria areas, we're still seeing extremely high nitrate concentrations and widespread toxicity. Also very poor biological health, and most sites are not showing improvement, although we are seeing some decreases in loads at some locations, although the concentrations remain high. But generally, these waters are not healthy for aquatic life and are not supporting recharge of drinkable groundwater. And now Angela Schroeder is going to present a summary of the draft order. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnston.
One quick question for Karen.
It's got to be quick because I wanted everyone to...
Oh, do you want us to wait till the end of the...
Oh, exactly.
Oh, I thought we were waiting till the end of individual presentation.
Oh, no.
I'll wait.
This is one presentation.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll wait.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, good morning, Chairman Young, members of the board. Again, my name is Angela Schroeder. I am a senior engineering geologist and also the program manager for the Agriculture Regulatory Program. So, as Lisa mentioned, the Water Board received more than 2,000 comment letters from stakeholders throughout the process over the last 3.5 years. While every comment is unique, the public comments received consistently focused on a few main issues that the draft order should address. The first comment that we have heard from all stakeholders, primarily agriculture, but also environmental too, also environmental stakeholders, is that every farm is unique and has an individual unique threat to water quality based upon the characteristics of those farms, and that the draft order should address those characteristics and not be one size fits all. In addition, comments also specified that the draft order should focus on the most impaired areas of the region. Comments stated that those farms that are in the unimpaired areas of the region should not be subject to the same requirements as those that are in the most severely impaired. In addition, we also heard from stakeholders that among the highest priorities for this order should be the prioritization of public health and drinking water protection. Finally, we also heard that the draft agricultural order should build upon the success of the 2004 conditional waiver. So based upon this input and the severity of the water quality conditions that you heard described by Karen Worcester and also Matt Keeling, staff proposed three tiers based upon the individual characteristics of farms and threat to water quality. Tier one are for those farms which are the lowest threat to water quality. They are the farms that do not use chlorpyrifos and diazinon, are not in an area where surface water is impaired or near an impacted drinking water well. And if those farms produce crops that are known to low nitrogen to groundwater, they must be less than 50 acres. In addition, Tier 1 also includes those farms which are certified sustainable, such as the Sustainable Practice Certification, which is conducted by the Central Coast Vineyard Team. Tier 2 includes those farms which are the moderate threat to water quality. They are the farms that use chlorpyrifos or diazinon, and are in an impaired surface water area or near an impacted drinking water well. If those farms produce a crop that is those that are higher risk for loading nitrogen, those farms would be between 50 and 500 acres. Tier three are those farms which we consider to be the highest threat to water quality. There's two criteria for tier three. Those are the farms that use chlorpyrifos or diazinon and discharge to an impaired surface water body that's impaired for toxicity or pesticides. The second criteria is if that farm is growing crops that are at higher risk for loading nitrogen to groundwater, those farms are greater than or equal to 500 acres. In response to the comments that the draft order should build upon the success of the conditional waiver adopted by the board in 2004, I'll just start by reminding the board what those conditions were. So the 2004 conditional waiver stated that discharges must meet water quality standards. They must file and update the notice of intent. They must develop and implement a farm plan. Discharges must also submit an annual management practice checklist, conduct surface receiving water monitoring, and also comply with education and time schedules. Again, these requirements in black are those that are part of the 2004 conditional waiver adopted by the board in 2004 that growers are currently required to comply with. In response to the severe water quality conditions that you've heard about from Matt Keeling, we've also introduced or proposed new requirements to address threats to groundwater. Those are shown here in blue. Groundwater monitoring reporting, backflow prevention, and proper well abandonment. In addition, staff is proposing to improve the reporting for the agricultural order by adding an annual compliance form that's submitted online. And this annual compliance form would replace the management practice checklist. So these requirements, the black ones that you see here from the 2004 conditional waiver, as well as these requirements, these new proposed requirements in blue, make up the requirements for the 2012 draft order Tier 2. These are those farms which we consider to be the moderate threat to water quality. Also recognizing that Tier 1 growers, those that are a lower threat to water quality, should have lesser requirements, staff is proposing to remove the annual compliance form from the Tier 1 requirements. So Tier 1 farms would have no annual reporting for on-farm, with the exception of filing and updating their notice of intent. In response to the comments that the draft order should focus on the areas that are most impaired and those farms which are the highest risk, the draft order also proposes new requirements for Tier 3 farms, which are those farms that are the relatively highest threat to water quality. Those new requirements are individual discharge monitoring, also for a subset of Tier 3, which will have an increased nitrate loading risk, to develop an irrigation nutrient management plan, which is to achieve certain nutrient balance targets, as well as a subset of the Tier 3 farms that are adjacent to a sediment temperature or turbidity impaired creek would also have to submit a water quality buffer plan. So again, these are the proposed summary of the proposed requirements in the draft order. The center is Tier 2, which is the moderate threat. On the left, you see Tier 1, which is the lower threat, which are the farms that we are proposing to reduce the reporting requirements for, and Tier 3 increased requirements for the higher threat farms. At this point, I also want to point out that to address concerns about reporting, the draft order specifies that the precise locations of groundwater wells and any trade secrets, secret processes, or other proprietary information are protected from public disclosure. I also want to mention at this point that staff recognizes that many growers have already taken proactive actions to protect water quality. For example, the Sustainable and Practice Certified Vineyard Growers require specific water quality practices. The Avocado Commission has indicated that they encourage sediment control and advancing stormwater protection. The cut flower industry has indicated that they are reducing the use of chemicals. And the Strawberry Commission has indicated that many growers already meet the proposed nutrient balance targets. Staff commends these growers and wants to ensure that all growers are doing their part to protect water quality. So let's look at the farms and acreage in the tiers. You'll notice that Tier 1 and Tier 2 include the most acreage and farms in the region. And in fact, Tier 1 includes the most farms in the region at 55%. Tier 3 includes the least amount of farms, 3% of the farms at 103 and 51,000 acres. This acreage and farms are based upon the information submitted by growers in the electronic notice of intent. The draft order also includes incentives for those growers who can demonstrate efforts to reduce the threat to water quality and implement water quality improvements. For example, sustainable certifications, being able to transfer to a lower tier, as well as encouraging cooperative monitoring projects, cooperative water quality improvement projects, such as treatment wetlands or managed aquifer recharge, or other efforts, for example, by a watershed group. These projects could propose alternative monitoring and reporting, as well as alternative time schedules. In addition, the draft order also includes flexibility and alternatives. Individuals or groups can request specific orders for commodity or for a specific individual farming operation. It specifies that third-party groups are acceptable and also provides the flexibility for dischargers to comply with both surface receiving water monitoring as well as groundwater monitoring, either individually or as a cooperative effort. The draft order also allows growers to comply with groundwater monitoring by submitting existing groundwater data if it's available. The draft order also includes flexibility for growers to evaluate nitrate loading risk by farm or by unit. For example, if a grower has numerous crop types on a farm and nitrate loading risk is high for only a particular area, they can evaluate that nitrate loading risk by unit. The draft order also includes alternatives to the Tier 2 reporting of total nitrogen applied, the Tier 3 certified irrigation nutrient management plan, as well as the Tier 3 water quality buffer plan. So this, taking a closer look at the farms and the tiers, this is a map of the Central Coast region. The farms, Tier 1 farms, again, are the lowest relative threat to water quality. They're shown here in blue dots. Notice that Tier 1 farms are located throughout the region. They really are not concentrated in any particular area. If we look at crop types, Tier 1 farms predominantly include vineyards, also orchards, as well as some row crops, both berries and vegetables in nurseries and greenhouses. But predominantly, the crop type in this tier are the vineyards. Moving on to Tier 2, this is those farms which would be considered a moderate threat to water quality. They are shown here in green. So in response to comments that the draft order focus on this impaired areas of the region, notice that Tier 2 are starting to get a closer focus on the areas where we see the most impairments, as described by Matt Keeling and Karen Worcester. so predominantly in the Salinas Valley as well as the Santa Maria area. In terms of the types of farms we see in Tier 2, we see predominantly row crops in Tier 2, the berries and vegetables. We still also see orchards, nurseries, greenhouses, and some vineyards in Tier 2. Again, this is based upon the information submitted by growers in the electronic notice of intent. So finally, this is a map of the Tier 3 farms. They are shown here in red. And now we are focused almost exclusively in the areas where we see the most severe impairments, the Salinas Valley and also lower parts of the Santa Maria. In terms of the types of farms in Tier 3, again, this is only 103 farms, and so now we can start getting very specific. In this tier, we see 96 farms that grow row crops, primarily vegetables, but also see just a handful of other farm types, approximately 5 strawberry farms, 1 orchard, and 1 greenhouse. So this is a summary of the tier, the farms. Again, the Tier 1's in blue, Tier 2 is in green, and the Tier 3 is in red. Again, 97% of the farms are in Tier 1 and Tier 2, and 3% of the farms are in Tier 3. So let's take a closer look at the Tier 3 requirements. This is for the 103 farms in the 51,000 acres. The subset, the Tier 3 farms have to conduct individual discharge monitoring as well as irrigation nutrient management plan and a water quality buffer plan. If we look at the subset of the Tier 3 farms that would have to prepare an irrigation nutrient management plan, staff estimates that about 61 of the 103 farms would have to prepare the irrigation and nutrient management plan. Similarly, staff estimates that approximately 58 farms would have to prepare a water quality buffer plan. And this is based upon looking at the information in the electronic notice intent as well as the locations of those specific farms. So one of the most significant improvements of the draft order is improved monitoring and reporting to evaluate progress towards water quality improvement and verify the effectiveness of the order. So what new information is gained? Well, from all farms, we get data to identify groundwater impacted by nitrate, get data to protect drinking water beneficial uses. We also receive new information on individual pesticides detected in surface water, as well as get an identification of farms that are certified sustainable. From many farms, we also get information to identify those that have an increased nitrate loading risk. We get the identification of practices that are implemented, as well as indicators that practices are effective and pollutant load is reduced. From a few farms, those higher risk farms, we also get the certification, the certification of irrigation and nutrient management plans, data to evaluate the quality of individual discharges, protection of adjacent surface water, and verification of progress and effectiveness according to specific indicators and milestones. This new information will enable the Water Board to efficiently and effectively evaluate compliance and prioritize farms for appropriate follow-up based on threat to water quality and ensure the protection of safe drinking water sources. It will also allow the Water Board to evaluate the effectiveness of the order. Most importantly, the new information will help us to learn more and adapt as we move forward to continuously improve the order and its implementation. So in conclusion, the draft order is responsive to the input from stakeholders. It does address comments that requirements should be based upon individual farms and not one size fits all. The draft order does focus on the areas of the region that are the most impaired. It does include requirements prioritize the protection of drinking water and groundwater. And the draft order does build on the 2004 conditional waiver and maintains similar requirements for a large percentage of growers and reduces reporting for more than half. It increases requirements for a small percentage of growers, given an increased threat to water quality. The draft order complies with the Water Code, plans, and policies, and is reasonable given the severity of water quality conditions and impacts of drinking water. And now Michael Thomas will speak to you about implementation and enforcement.
Board. Does it sound like this is on?
No, it doesn't.
And how about that?
Hang on 1 second, Michael. Miss, Madam Reporter, can you hear everything okay?
Right on, yeah. I'm letting them know.
Would you prefer being in a different location?
Maybe after a break.
We'll take a break in a bit, and if you want to move anywhere, just let me know. Okay.
Good afternoon, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'm going to talk a little bit about enforcement related to this conditional waiver of waste discharge requirements, the order that is before the board today. This 2012 conditional waiver has administrative type requirements, and that is enrollment, fees, and online reporting, and submittal due dates for that reporting. And staff can pursue enforcement actions for violations of those administrative type actions. And the typical sequence that we would follow is when we find that there is a violation, we usually make a phone call or send an email, and the majority of violations are resolved at that point without taking further action. If we need to, we'll send a letter to the discharger if we can't get a hold of them otherwise. If a letter does not work, we send a notice of violation. Again, the majority of the majority of issues are resolved at that point. Rarely we have to send a second notice of violation or move on to proposed fines. If we do move on to proposed fines, we usually offer a settlement that is a fraction of the maximum allowable, and the majority of those cases are settled without coming to the board. But if a discharger would like to, they can come to the board and have a hearing before the board, and that has happened, I think, if I remember correctly, once with respect to the 2004 order in 8 years. And when it does come to the board, if it comes to the board can dismiss the proposal for fines. They can decrease the proposed amount or increase the proposed amount. At the last workshop in February, we heard a lot about this fear factor. What about enforcement of water quality standards? When the order is adopted, will staff pursue enforcement action immediately against growers for violation of water quality standards? The answer to that is no, period. The draft permit states, attachment A, page 2, the Central Coast Water Board recognizes that dischargers may not achieve immediate compliance with all requirements. Thus, this order provides reasonable schedules for dischargers to reach full compliance over many years by implementing management practices and monitoring and reporting programs that demonstrate and verify measurable progress annually. That is a quote from the permit. So what does it look like? We obviously want growers to eventually achieve water quality objectives. So what does that look like? It's an iterative process where growers have to implement management practices, monitor and report effectiveness to the board, and then adjust based on those results and then keep improving those management practices to eventually achieve the water quality standards. Now, it is possible that some growers will not do implementation. They will do little or no implementation. They may believe that the water board doesn't have authority to regulate them, and so they will choose not to. And in that case, we will pursue a different avenue, and that is waste discharge requirements. Waste discharge requirements is a different kind of order, and so if growers are not complying with this conditional waiver, we would consider waste discharge requirements. Waste discharge requirements often do have water quality standards in them, and they are enforceable. And there are cases right now that we are considering for pursuing waste discharge requirements. We're not working on those because we have been working on this order continuously for 3.5 years.
Well, can you just quickly clarify, what do you mean cases? Agricultural cases?
Yes.
Cases?
There are cases where operations that are not complying with the existing order, in our opinion, and I can't go into details about it because it could be a pending action in front of the board. But there are such cases, and we will pursue those. We We need to move from the condition on the left here, which is not protective of beneficial uses, which is causing the kinds of pollution that you have heard about extensively today and in every previous workshop and hearing that we've had. We need to move to the conditions on the right. There are solutions available, and we can do this. We've heard that growers are worried about compliance with water quality objectives as soon as the order is adopted. I've just explained that that is not the case, that we will not be taking enforcement action on water quality objectives. But what we talk about internally is not how we are going to enforce water quality objectives immediately. What we talk about is that the best defense for growers is a good offense. What they need to be doing is demonstrating the implementation of practices and providing the information that verifies the effectiveness of those practices. That is by far the best defense that they could possibly have. These solutions are available. There are places in our region. This board has allocated tens of millions of dollars towards projects to demonstrate that there are practices available and that they work. There are also ag-developed programs, like the sustainability and practice certification. We didn't develop this, the ag industry did. The standards for sustainability and practice are, they look at the farm in its entirety. They consider the worker, soil fertility, cover crops, wildlife, native plants, and irrigation, and others. They look at the whole system. Operations that are SIP certified are automatically in tier one of this order. And the ag industry, other segments of the ag industry are free to pursue and develop these kinds of programs, and this order, this draft order, encourages them to do so. Briefly, I want to mention the amount of resources that we've allocated to this effort. All the people listed here have been working on this project over the past 3.5 years. Those that are listed in bold at the beginning have been spending almost 100% of their time on this project. It does not include the executive officer and the assistant executive officer or board time. We have spent more time on this project than any other project before the board. And we are tying up resources and not doing other things that we should be doing, that we are responsible for doing. That includes implementation of the ag program. The board adopted an order in 2004, and we are not implementing the things that we need to implement to deal with the severe water quality pollution problems because we are spending time on this, bringing this order to the board again and again in workshops or hearings over the past 3.5 years. We're not taking action on public health protection. There are drinking water problems that we need to be addressing. We have identified several. We know there are several more. And we need to be taking action on those. And we haven't been doing it because our resources are tied up on this delay. There are also total maximum daily load orders that we are required to do by law. Many of these orders address the most severe agriculture water quality pollution issues. And they rely on this order. They refer to this order and they rely on this order for implementation. We need to get this order adopted because it affects many other things that we do. We're also planning to bring basin plan amendments to the board. Our basin plan describes the water quality conditions in our regions, our resources, and the programs that are in place to address the most severe problems. We have major basin plan amendments that we need to bring before this board, and we're not doing it. The Water Board's mission, as a reminder, is to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of California's water resources for the benefit of present and future generations. We're not doing that. These conditions do not protect resources for this generation or future generations. The water quality data that you have seen, that we brought to you multiple times, that is established in the record and in the literature, demonstrates the severity of the water pollution problems in our region and the number of people that are affected and the public health threat, which is extraordinary. We need to move from the condition on the left to the condition on the right. The State Water Board has an environmental justice policy, and the number one goal listed is to integrate environmental justice considerations into the development, adoption, implementation, and enforcement of board decisions, regulations, and policies. We are not doing this. Sonia Lopez. This is a picture of Sonia Lopez and her son, Leonardo. They're from the San Gerardo area. And they are affected by the pollution, the groundwater pollution, and the extraordinary costs that are being incurred by that community to deal with it. She said it better than any of us. Our problem is going to be your problem. It's everyone's problem. There are solutions, but we need the people in charge of our communities to do something about it. That's us. The Water Board is the only agency with the authority and the responsibility to address this water quality problem. The Port of Colon Water Quality Act says the board must be prepared to exercise its full power and jurisdiction to protect the quality of waters in the state from degradation. We are not doing this. Matt pointed out earlier, this quote from the Health and Safety Code, every citizen of California has the right to pure and safe drinking water. We have been arguing about this for 3.5 years. We've been meeting with people who tell us that it's not true, that the public does not have a right to clean water. They have an obligation to clean it up if they want to use it. It's not true. They do have a right to clean water, and our job as the Water Board and Water Board staff is to provide that to them and to protect them and their public health. We're not doing it. In conclusion, water quality degradation is severe and it's getting worse. The more data we get, the worse it looks. The threat to public health is paramount. We must act now to comply with our laws, our plans, and our policies to do what is required of us. We cannot negotiate away protection of public health or public resources. We often hear that we should delay and continue to negotiate. If we just negotiate a little while longer, perhaps we would resolve this. Resolving this is dealing with the public health threat and the pollution problem. It is not negotiating away protection of public health or public resources. The California Constitution has a public trust doctrine policy in it, and we are responsible for protecting the public trust and implementing that doctrine. Delay prevents implementation and action on our priority cases, as I've already mentioned. It's a real delay. It's a real delay of these other priority actions that we are supposed to be acting on. An unwillingness to submit data or specified information is not a reason for delay. All of the other parties that this board regulates, they all submit information to this board, and it is public information. An unwillingness to submit information to demonstrate a reduction in pollution load is not a reason to delay. Solutions are available. This board has allocated, as I said, tens of millions of dollars to demonstrate those solutions. They're out there, and they can be implemented. That concludes my comments.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thomas. For the rest of you, we're going to take a break sometime before noon. And I know Congressman Farr needs to. Is it leave by noon? Okay. We could go and do our own questions of staff now if you want, or we can take a 10-minute break right now.
I just have a very brief question. In our packet, there's a recommendation slide we did not see. Is that for now or later?
We will come back when all of the other presentations have been made, and the executive officer will make a recommendation.
Thank you.
Do you guys want to take a break for 10 minutes? You do? Okay. So, folks, 10 minutes. We'll come back, believe it or not, at 11:20, and I'm going to start speaking and asking you to take your seats.
They think we should have done it.